Okay, so today is the last class in our computational biology this semester. First, just some administrative matters, just to make sure we agree. The final exam will be on December 19th, which I believe is Thursday. Does everybody agree that December 19th is Thursday? Okay, good. Okay. It will be at 2 to 4:30. The room is given as Graduate Chemistry 128. Okay, and my belief is that Graduate Chemistry is the new chemistry building. Does anybody who's a life scientist agree or disagree? Have you ever heard of the term new chemistry building? Is there anybody here who's ever heard of the new chemistry building? You have. What is the new chemistry building? Big chemistry, okay? Big chemistry, okay? So, the final exam will be in room 128 grad chem, and if it's not, we'll find each other. So try to go there, try to find it, and hopefully that will work out. Okay, what will be on the final exam? My vision is that the final exam is going to have two parts to it. There is going to be a CS part of it and a biology part of it, okay? You will have to identify yourself as a CS person or a biology person, just for record keeping. I'd like to see that the CS people, in principle, do better on the CS part. But basically, I'm going to try to have half the questions from what I would call the biology part, half the questions from the CS part. You will get two grades. I will basically add them together, and that will be your final grade. That's my vision. We'll see if something weird happens. My hope is that these are going to be basically short answer type questions, you know, fill in the blank and short answer type questions. And so my intended way for you to study for this course is to read the notes, make sure things make sense to you, make sure you know the lingo, make sure you understand why, you know, why we look study things and stuff like that. Okay? And that is sort of my vision for the final. My hope is it will not take the full 2.5 hours. Okay, but we'll see what happens. My intention is that that will not be the case. Okay? But I do want you there at 2 o'clock, and my intention is that when the room is empty, I will leave. So don't say, well, it's only going to be a short exam, I can show up at 4, okay, because I might not be there. Show up at 2. That's a firm requirement, okay? Any questions about the final exam or anything like that? Okay? The other thing is that your projects are due. In principle, anybody who has them today or by the end of class today gets the project with brownie points. And so I would like to see any brownie point copies. Some people have turned in a couple. I mean, how many people here know what a brownie is? Like, that's an interesting. How many people have heard the phrase brownie points? Several people. How many people have know what a brownie is? Okay? Actually, several people, but they're probably knowing the wrong way. It's not a cookie. Let me tell you, a brownie is not being used to as a cookie here. Does anybody know what a brownie is? Now, how do you think they know what a brownie is? Okay? Okay, a brownie is a sort of a, as I understand, a little Girl Scout, okay, what I usually think of the brownies as being, that they were a, what you call it, a children's organization for girls, and I gather that you accumulated points like merit badges. You were a Boy Scout, you got merit badges. And I think the brownie points is coming from that. Any questions? That will not be on the test, but we can put that there. Okay, so if you did not turn in the project now, I definitely want the project at or before the final. Okay, if you have it before, get a printed copy, stick it in my mailbox. Okay, and if you turn it to me, I'll have the final if you want. Okay, any questions about the project? If there would be a physical object that is turned in that I can grade. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, good. So what I'd like to talk about today, this is sort of the end of the last topic. Oh, question. What? Well, the format should be, there should be enough of a paper that I should be able to figure out what you did by reading that paper. Okay? Hopefully there will be supporting objects. Like, for example, in this paper you will tell me, oh, I wrote this program, the program did this, I did these experiments, I learned this. Okay, and there should be then the supporting evidence of the program and what, you know, maybe any tables or so you produce. So I should be able to look at this object that you turn in and be able to say that I have some idea of what you did, you know, and you know, what your effort level was and things like that. Any other questions about the project? Okay, good.
Okay, so I'd like to talk about, we've been having a, the last several classes have been about evolution. And I'd like to sort of conclude with, we've looked over the last, well, I guess, the last two classes in a snow day. We have talked about different ways of reconstructing evolutionary trees from distance data, meaning for every bear species, how far apart they were, or character data, what properties did it have. I'd like to talk about one other type of evolutionary problem where there has been a lot of work in the computational biology community on, which is kind of interesting, on trying to reconstruct the history of genome arrangement events. So one thing that is that again, most of the mutations we have talked about this semester have been these, we sort of talked about sort of point mutations. Somehow, somewhere in the course of the DNA duplication event, a little micro problem event happens and there's a base gets changed or something like that. A base gets deleted or added or more likely sort of substituted. In fact, a lot of the large scale evident evolutionary events involve fairly drastic changes to the genome. Okay, if you look at the evolutionary history of organisms, there's often a duplication event when suddenly a chromosome, perhaps, an entire chromosome might be repeated, okay, or duplicated in the genome, or stuck into some other chromosome. Okay, and so you get sort of the duplication of a large number of genes. Okay, these duplication events turn out to be very important in evolutionary history because suddenly now that you have two working copies of each gene, in principle, other processes in evolution can now happen and mutate one of them and maybe it'll evolve a different function or something else will be interesting will happen. Okay? And sometimes you have, what I would call reversal events. Okay? Not where genes are sort of chromosomes are copied or duplicated. But sometimes you have a situation where part of the chromosome is deleted and put in backwards. Okay? So, you can have a...
you might have a chromosome here, and in the course of duplication or crossover or something like this, this hunk of DNA might get inserted in reverse order. So now the logical progression of the chromosome as you read it goes from here to there to there. Okay? And this can have effects on control regions of the genes, it can have effect in how they're expressed. Okay? These are important things that happen. You can also have sort of translocation events where genes move from one chromosome to another chromosome. Something gets cut out, a piece of DNA moves, gets cut out, gets stuck in someplace. Within bacterial species, there's sort of this notion of lateral transfer. We're used to thinking of phylogeny as being trees, evolutionary trees. In the beginning, there was, Adam the bacteria, okay, and as time went by, it had descendants, and these split and they evolved things. In fact, there is evidence that in some bacteria species, genes move sort of across different places in the tree. The phylogenetic tree of bacteria is not a, not a pure tree, but that there's other things coming, and genes are moving around between species, okay? And in reconstructing really what the history of life is, it's a complicated business, okay? And it's larger scale changes that are happening that you would like to reconstruct, okay? Any questions about that? Okay,
the thing that surprised me when I first heard about this, you'll see that the problems we're going to look at when we talk about analyzing these large-scale gene operations tend to be very pretty algorithmic problems, okay, and they're so pretty that they often didn't really come from the biologists, okay,
and so this is part of when I first hear this thing, I'm sort of very skeptical that these kind of changes happened in genomes. But in fact, it is true that cells can be surprisingly resilient to losing large hunks of genomes. It's wrong to think of a cell as being a, let's say the genome of an organism as being a computer program.
You know, if you take a typical computer program, you cut out part of it, the program crashes, and that's the end of it. Okay? With cells, can be surprisingly robust in the face of these large-scale changes. And I guess the example that interests that I find most convincing is in cancer. If you look at cancer cells, cancer is a genetic disease, and what basically happens is that there's genetic changes, and suddenly a lot of the DNA copying and repair mechanisms don't work as well. And for several reasons, these cells end up reproducing more rapidly. But when you take a look at a cancer cell, whole hunks of chromosomes can be missing, okay, and duplicated into lots of different pieces, okay? And so they're fairly large-scale changes that happen. I mean, you look at it through an eye and a microscope and look at it and say, you know, bad things have happened, okay, and the cell continues to live and do something, okay, not necessarily what it did before, okay, but the world is more robust. So it is quite reasonable that one of these mutations, crossover events happens, or gene duplication events happen, the organism doesn't necessarily die, okay? And I guess a lot of human diseases are caused by the fact that some people have extra chromosomes, okay? So there's some, you know, genetic diseases where, you know, someone will have, instead of an X and a Y, maybe they'll have two X's and a Y. And, you know, bad things happen, but not you know, but these are living people and functioning people. So, you know, so in fact, these large-scale events do happen, and they are important. Any questions? Okay. So, let's not go with this thing. So what is the, we're going to look here just at a special class of sort of genome, large-scale to genome events, namely gene reversals, okay? We have seen, I mean, throughout the semester, one of the things that's been driving what we're doing is the idea that between species, there are homologous genes, okay? If you have the genome of human and you have the genome of mouse, okay, a large number of the genes are in common. I mean, there was recently some of you may have heard in the popular press or something that within the last couple of weeks, a analysis showing the similarity between the human genome and the mouse genome has been published. And it's the overwhelming number of genes we share with mice. Okay, the difference between man and mouse is not that we have more genes or better genes. Okay, because basically we have the same set of genes. You can find in almost every gene in human, you can find a homologous gene in mouse, and vice versa. Okay, the difference presumably is how they are expressed, and you know, and stuff like that. Okay, so between two different species, you can find homologous genes, okay? And these genes are sort of rearranged in the genome by these large-scale events, like, for example, a reversal event. Here, the genes were ordered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 along the chromosome. A reversal event happens, and now these three genes were put in backwards. And now you have the ordering is 1, gene 1, gene 4, gene 3, gene 2, gene 5. Okay?
And so one aspect of analyzing evolutionary data would be,
suppose you have the human genome, suppose you have the mouse genome. You can, by doing a homology search, figure out where is the homologous gene in human to mouse. They are not going to be in the same order. I mean, we differ from mouse by something like 80 million years or so, is my understanding. Okay, that's where sort of the common ancestor is. And during this time, there's been a lot of shuffling that's been happening. And it would be interesting, one of the things that you would like to do is by looking at the order of the genes to try to predict, figure out, reconstruct what happened, what genes got shuffled, you know, what reversal events happened, okay, to turn us from man to mouse. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? So, again, there have been estimates. The estimate that I have is that the difference between man and mouse is that there's been something on the order of about 200 crossover operations.
That is the primary difference between man and mouse. Okay? You know, there's other things. Okay, so we're not that close to, you know, so we're not mice, but we're, you know, the large scale differences between us can probably be explained by something like 200 of these crossovers that have happened. And in fact, one thing I can guarantee you is that now that the genome, full genome for man and mouse has been published, there are people busy trying to analyze and figure out what is the smallest number of reversals it takes? What was the most likely sequence of reversals that happened, okay, in the course of evolution? Any questions? Okay. Well, why would they want to know this? Well, first of all, presumably, interesting things happened along the way. Okay? So part of it is that,
I mean, there's this whole history of why do you want to know the evolutionary tree of among species in the first place? Okay? In one sense, it's interesting. In one sense, you want to try to figure out what was the event that caused the branching to happen. It may very well be that some of these branching points, the things that separate the mice from, let's say, other types of mammals, may have been the results of crossover. And by doing sort of an analysis of the gene work, the order of genes in all these species, you might even get a fuller picture of what evolution is. Okay? You might learn something about the function of the genes. You know, why was it that crossing it over did something different? Okay? It made it more likely to be expressed. It made it spread more heavily, less heavily, things like that. Okay? So I think that there is interest in this whole area of comparative genomics is trying to be, look at our genome, look at somebody else's genome, figure out what's different and why is it interesting. Okay. Any questions? So how can we analyze this? And the interesting thing is that they come out to be two very, very nice kind of, there's a nice way to sort of view this in computer science terms. Okay. And this is the problem of what we would call sorting with reversals. Okay. We can take the human genome, okay, and label all the genes in order from 1 to n. Okay, there's 30,000 genes in human, they're homologous to mouse. We'll lay them end to end, here's a number from 1 to 30,000. When we do the homologous gene, when we now do a homologous search in mice, we may learn that this first gene is 5, the second gene was number 96, the third gene was 97. With respect to the human number, okay? So we now have what is basically the human genome can be thought of as an identity permutation of genes. And the mouse species genome is going to be another permutation of the same genes. Once we have assigned homology, we can view the second genome as being a, permutation. And we really are interested in trying to reconstruct the history of reversal would be if we assume that reversal events are rare and big time changes. You're interested in how do you sort these genes, okay, using the smallest number of reversals or the cheapest cost, lowest cost sequence of reversals, okay? Okay, if you believe that these evolutionary changes are rare, the lowest cost sequence of reversals should tell you something about what the step of large-scale gene events that happen in going from one species to another. Okay? Any questions? Does everybody see why the crop reduces to that of sorting genes? Sorting. Because once we make the mapping between the genes, and again, whenever you look at any paper these days on published in Science or any one of these papers that are published about the new sequence of a new organism, one thing they will always show you is for the closest species, the closest previously sequenced species, where is it that the genes, the homologous genes, cross over? Okay? So you tend to a standard picture to see in one of these genome papers. Is something that looks like this, okay, where here is one species, here is another, and it shows you where are the equivalent species on the genome, the equivalent genes on the genome. Any questions? So once we extract this, okay, I think that our problem reduces to how do we sort the genes using the smallest number of reversals? Any questions? Question. Okay, so you're saying why are there reversals and not block moves? Okay? You want to claim that instead the evolutionary event that you would like to think might happen a lot if somehow a hunk of DNA gets cut out and inserted someplace else, okay? These translocation events do happen. My understanding is reversals happen more frequently, okay? If somebody's got this sort of crossover operation that's sort of happening, you know, and so the bottom line is reversals are more common than translocation events, okay, for large scale rearrangement. And that's one reason why we will talk about reversals, okay? In fact, the general theory we'll talk about can be worked out for more complicated sets of operations, like reversals and translocations, okay? So, but in general, I think reversals happen more often, and that's why people talk about them. Any questions? Okay?
So, one aspect about sorting with reversals, though, is to think carefully about what is happening
when we do one of these reversal events. Okay? If you have a genome, remember there was a 5' end and a 3' end, that the genes went left to right, got red, left to right. We have a gene, you know, sequence, let's say A and B, and we reverse the strand of the genome. If we stick it in and insert it backwards, what we're going to do is get A backwards, B backwards. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that? It's somehow before, with respect to the original sequence, these genes are now on the lower strand. They were originally on the upper strand. Now we do the reversal operation, they're going to be on the lower strand. Does everybody sort of see that? Okay? We're getting inserted backwards somehow. Okay? So when we do a reversal of a piece of DNA, we're not going to every gene and explicitly reversing. We're reversing the whole hunk of them. And so, in fact, when you do a reversal,
somehow the genes in principle get inserted backwards. Okay? And so, you know, when we talk about sorting a problem, in fact, sometimes when you're analyzing these things, you're analyzing the genes, you assume that you get
this permutation and you want to sort it. A probably more realistic model would be one where you get for every element in the permutation, whether it is upside down or not, relative to the original gene. And so now you get a signed permutation, where for every element in the genome, you get a notion as to whether or not it is reversed. Okay? So to properly sort this thing, you've got to get rid of the reversal signs on this particular three genes I drew. If you do one reversal here, what are you going to get? So you get 4, 3, and 2 properly oriented, but in the wrong place. The only way to, let's say, sort this thing would be to sort of explicitly use a reversal here to remove the, you know, remove it. Okay? So be aware that there is a difference between signed reversals and unsigned reversals. Namely, whether or not we're going to keep track that not only that each gene has to get in the right position, but it has to get on the right strand in the right orientation. Any questions? And this will make a big difference algorithmically. Okay? Any questions?
Okay. So what are the algorithmic problems we might want to ask with this? Turns out that there's sort of two different kinds of algorithmic problems or that I get asked about reversal questions. The first one is actually more of a discrete mathematical problem, okay, which is what we call a diameter problem. Suppose I give you as input n permutations, you know, there's n permutations, possible rearrangements of genes. Okay? Reversals map some permutation to some other, every reversal maps a permutation to another permutation. We can ask ourselves, how many reversals always suffice to sort? So suppose I tell you that I have some permutation on n genes. Is it possible to sort every gene, every possible permutation on n genes using n reversals?
using 2n reversals, using n squared reversals. The diameter problem asks us, what is the maximum number of reversals you might need to sort it? If you design those sorting, you could always use an infinite number of reversals to sort something by just keeping reversing things and not making any progress. But assuming you're trying to make progress towards sorting, what is the smallest number of reversals that you know will suffice to have the genome sorted? Okay, and that is what we mean by the diameter problem. Okay? There is also the distance question, which says as S is input, you're given two permutations. Okay? And you ask, what is the smallest number of reversals it takes to take that one permutation and map it to the other? Okay? So this one is sort of an algorithmic question. This one is probably more of a discrete mathematics type question. It's a property of the type of reversal operator you are, an n. Okay? And you get some function of n back as an answer. Okay?
Any questions?
Which one of these more closely resembles the biological question of reconstructing evolutionary history? Okay, is it the algorithmic problem or the existential question? Okay. So, which of these is two problems I've just proposed? Which one is more interesting to biologists?
Should be more interesting to biologists. Yeah. The distance one.
The distance one says I give you man and mouse. How much does it take to turn a man into a mouse? Okay? The first one says I give you any, I'm only going to give you the human. And I want to know how many reversals do I know will it take human to any other possible ordering? Okay, man, Martian. What's the most that? What is the worst? And sometimes, what is the worst genome? How much will it take to sort the worst possible genome? Okay, so I know that in fact, if I give you a budget of that many reversals, I know you can get the job done. This is the real problem of let's say biological significance. This is sort of an associated mathematical problem of interest. Any questions? Okay. So let's look at a very special case of the reversal problem. Okay, just to get sort of a flavor of it. There's a large literature on these reversal problems. The one that I would like to take a look at here, okay, is a special class of reversals where the reversals all have to include one of the endpoints. This is not a necessarily biologically motivated example, okay, but it's representative of this kind of a classic problem, okay? So I don't want to defend the model too strongly, okay? But suppose we are given a permutation, and we want to sort it with reversals, where, okay, every reversal, okay, has to include the top, okay? You sort of think of this as a permutation where one end is stuck on the table, one end, it's going up in the air. We want to reverse it, sort it using prefix reversals, okay? Namely, reversals that include the top of the stack. Okay? This is sometimes called pancake sorting because if you had a stack of pancakes, you stick a spatula in under some of the pancakes and reverse the whole stack, the top of the stack gets reversed. So if you stick the spatula in under this four, 3 and 4 get reversed, okay? And if we now, this is not a prefix reversal sort. So let's try sorting
set of pancakes using prefix reversals. Suppose I give you, I want to sort them so that they are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And the stack is now, 6, 5, 3, 1, 2, 1, 4, 2. How can we sort this using prefix reversals? Does anyone want to propose the scheme? Let us sort this without a general algorithm. How are we going to sort this one?
Well, the first reversal contains all the
Well, they took all the elements, stick it under the whole thing, and now we have 6, 5, 3, 1, 4, 2.
Now we reclaim the thought, and you look up the whistle and the reclaim.
Okay, now we could bring 5 to the top. But it's not necessary, right? 5 and 6 are pretty happy.
Now bring 4 to the top.
Now you want to bring 4 to the top, 4, 2. Okay, then go underneath here, and now we've got 4, 2, 1, 3. Is that right?
Yes.
And now how do we do it? You want an output of this is the y. Now we're going to put 3 in this place.
Yes.
Now I've got 2, 1, 3.
Yes.
And now flip this one. Okay? So let's look at the diameter problem here. If I give you a stack of n pancakes, how many reversals can you give me a strategy such that I know I can only sort those reversals, those pancakes in a certain number of reversals? And I'm hearing 2n. What? Why is it 2n? So the sort strategy, I strategy that we like to do is to take the one that belongs on the bottom. In one reversal, I can flip under it, okay, and bring it to the top. Then I can do another reversal, okay, to put that one down below where it goes. And so using two flips, I can bring everything, the largest, the next largest, the next largest. Two times n reversals will suffice to flip. Does everybody agree with that? So we have proven the diameter for this is at most 2n. Everybody agree with that? Can anybody come up with a proof, a lower bound on this function as to how many reversals are necessary? Okay? Proof to be that a certain number of reversals are definitely needed. Okay? Any ideas how we might do that? Okay? Number of elements out of place. Well, number of elements out of place is probably, depends how you define out of place. Yes, you define the elements as being reversed. Let's say the desired numbers were 1 to n. If you had from n to 1, all the elements are out of place, but one reversal would bring them all back. So out of place is not a lower bound. Okay? Do we get anything to define in lower bound? Yeah? You want to interweave the odd and even numbers. So let's say like 1, what are the odd and even numbers? 1, 2, 3, 4, and you want to say, let's say this is 8, we would have 5, 6, 7, 8. And you say, this is going to be hard to sort. How hard is it to sort? Can you prove to me that this is going to take a certain number of reversals? Okay? How do I know one reversal won't suffice for sorting this? Okay. Any arguments? I will say that, in fact, one reversal will not sort this. Okay. And in fact, n minus one reversals are necessary to sort this. I can prove it. Why? How many? Let's say that we define for any permutation the number of break points as being the number of pairs of elements that are not next to whom they should be. Okay? So in this particular permutation, my original permutation, this was not a breakpoint. This was. How many breakpoints can I hope to erase on any reversal? What's the maximum number I can hope to erase? Okay? Namely, pairs of elements that are not connected adjacent to the elimination of it. In one reversal, how many breakpoints might I, how many adjacencies between proper elements might I create?
Yeah?
Only one. Only one. Why? Where is the only possible adjacency I can create? It'd be between the element that was on top and the element below my spatula, right? Does everybody sort of see that? that in any organization, if I count the number of gaps of breakpoints between an element and its successor, okay, I would argue that that there can be, as we showed the even organization that holds A minus one breakpoints, any reversal can erase and close one of them. And so we know that the number of reversals needed, the diameter, certainly it's less than 2n, because you've shown me a way to do it in 2n. Certainly, it has to be greater than or equal to n minus 1. Okay? Tightening this is a hard problem. Okay? Not, is an interesting problem. And here's sort of an example of a paper that actually tried to tighten these bounds. Okay? If anybody can see, read this thing. What is interesting about this paper? Okay, does anybody see it? If you look at some of the authors, okay? Does anyone see anything interesting about any of the authors of this paper? What is it? Bill Gates, that's not what I was mentioning. Okay, the fact that one of our, SD's advisor is on one of the authors. No, the interesting thing is that Bill Gates is actually, the Bill Gates who founded Microsoft studied this problem when he was in college, okay, so he didn't do too much in college, but this is one of the things that he did, okay? And in fact, you can see that what he basically proved was that instead of it being between n and 2n, he proved that it was between 5n over 3 and 17n over 6, 17n over 16, okay? And, you know. Well, the bottom line for studying it back then is that it's a cute problem, okay? And, in fact, prefix reversal, sorting with reversals was sort of basically a cute mathematical problem. In fact, prefix reversals have no real biological significance as opposed to general reversals. But then in the years since then, sort of as the evolutionary data has come out, it has become clear that, in fact, analyzing genome rearrangement events is analogous to sorting by reversals. Okay, and so it's got the interest in this problem, the practical interest in the problem came after this paper. Okay, but it's still a cute problem. Okay, yes. Yes. Well, no. What this bound in principle has nothing to do with the bound for generic sorting. We were bounding two different things. My bound here is on the number of reversals it takes to sort something. Your n log n bound in sorting is how many comparisons of pairs of elements does it take. Here we assume Bill Gates is planning the sequence of reversals, and you're not charging for Bill Gates' thought. You're charging for how many times Bill Gates uses a spatula. Okay? And so it's a different model when we talk about lower bounds and stuff like that. Here we're talking about not how much computation does it take. Because we don't really care. For analyzing evolution, we're willing to spend lots of computer cycles to do something, to get the right answer. We want to know what's the number of reversals we need. Okay? So it's a different, it's not a computational time problem. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Good. So let's look at, so we've looked at the diameter problem for prefix sorting. What about what about the actual algorithmic problem? I give you a permutation, and I want you to sort it using the smallest number of reversals. Okay? So here what I'm going to say is, I'm given as input a permutation. I want you to design a strategy here, okay, where, so I'm giving you an input a permutation. I want you to design a strategy that ends up with it being sorted that uses as few reversals as is possible to sort that particular permutation. Notice that if we use these 2n algorithms, it might very well, spend far more reversals than you might need to sort that individual permutation. I show you 2n will do the job. But in fact, if I tried to use my selection sort algorithm on that, I might do far more reversals than I need to. Okay? What's the proof of that? Well, my selection sort algorithm used 2n flips, and Bill Gates could get away with 5n over 3 of them. Okay? So the question I have for you is, can we design an algorithm such such that we know that we prefix short the permutation, and yet we don't use too many times more reversals than we actually have to.
Okay?
Basically, what we're going to try to do is to approximate the pancake distance.
Okay? For any permutation, give me a strategy that will sort it using at most twice as many moves, at most three times as many moves, ideally with as many moves, but the algorithmic complexity of this problem is tricky. Okay, so we're not going to find a strategy that I think is going to sort this in polynomial time. Okay? So, question? Okay?
So your strategy is to take the permutation and consolidate it into breakpoints. So you want to now consolidate it into runs. Okay? Now what you'd like to do is to make sure that you never break up any runs in the course of sorting it.
So I say, will you fix the
okay. So what you want to say here is you now have a permutation where let's say that this is going to be A, B, this might be the mate of A, this might be the mate of B, this might be C, and this might be the mate of C. Okay, well, really, in fact, these are increasing numbers. Okay, and what you're saying is that once you have a sorted run here, if this is a large enough run of more than one element, there is one potential breakpoint associated with this. This has to get moved to one of those. You say that by sticking it under reversal, by doing your sorting so you never flip, they never break the run. Okay? How that? Someone give me a strategy that sorts without ever breaking the run. Okay, and how many reversals does it take? If I give you that there are runs here, okay, by the same lower bound argument, you tell me that I need R reversals to make all these runs kiss. Okay, how many reversals will it take to erase a run? Okay, to erase a breakpoint. If I have to move them in these blocks. Okay? Someone give me a strategy. So for example, how can I make this B kiss this? Let's say I make this A. How can I make this A kiss that A? That would erase a run, right? How many reversals does that take? Two. How do I do it in two? Now I'm going to look at the bottom of the second run. That would give me A, C, what would the next one be? B, A. And now flip the top of A. And I don't see where I've created anything using anything. Okay? Does everybody see that? Not so easy now. Okay? Does everybody see that I can't make? You know, like it's not obvious to me how I make this A kiss this A in two reversals. Can I make it that A kiss that A in two reversals? I don't believe I can. Okay. How many reversals will suffice to make that A kiss that A?
Yeah?
You can do it in three. How can you do it in three? Now what you're saying is I can always take the A, B, C, A. Now it is, you're going to bring up the reverse, this whole thing. Now I've got A, C. What do I now have below it? Okay. A, B. And now I reverse this one again, and now I can kiss. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. So I will claim that if you want to say that you start with the top flip, okay, and focus on a particular pair you want to make hit,
it might require three reversals to do, right? I will say that if we work through the cases from starting from the bond analysis, starting from the element that's on top, it might take three reversals to sort of put where it should be. And that gives a strategy that will use at most three times the optimal number of flips.
Okay, does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay. The question is, can we do better than 3N flips? That now gives us a three times approximation of the optimal strategy. Is there a better way we might be able to do this? Okay, is there a hope to do it in less than three times optimal? Okay. And I want to claim that, in fact, you can do it in twice the optimal number of flips by being more careful.
Suppose we want, let's say, well, this is the permutation that I believe gave us trouble before. Okay? That this is the permutation that gave us trouble, right? We couldn't make the A kiss the A. But I claim that under those conditions, we could also erase the breakpoint on the B. If this is true, can we make the B kiss the B in two flips? Okay? Can we do that? Okay. So wait a minute. I think what they have claimed is that in fact there is a algorithm that will give you a factor two approximation, where we insist that the only one that is worth the top strip is one of its neighbors. What about B and B? Is there a way to make B and B kiss in two flips? How do we do that? Holding together B, C. Okay. Then what I've got here is C, A, then A, C. Then I've got B, A. Then if I reverse these two, it will suffice. Okay? So if I want to, I claim that I can always remove the top reversal thing with at most two reversals. I can always get murder the top run of somebody else with at most two reversals. Okay? So long as he's on the force space to murder the top guy with somebody else. Okay? And again, you have to do a little bit more analysis to give yourself all cases are covered.
Okay? Yeah. And so the idea is
we're never going to break any run. We're always going to limit ourselves to going with three break points. I claim that with two reversals, I can erase one run. This moves at twice the number of break points suffices to sort everything. This now gives me a factor two approximation on the minimum number of break points. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Now, ideally, we'd like to come up with one that gives us an optimal strategy for it.
Again, there are more complicated bounds known by using more complicated arguments of when do you flip what, okay? But I believe pancake sorting is still not known to be, is either hard, finding the minimum number of reversals either hard or assumed to be hard, okay? So, so we need to use approximation algorithms for that, or some exhaustive search techniques if you really want to find the smallest one. Any questions? Okay, so what is true about general? Again, for studying Bill Gates and studying pancakes, we were talking about prefix reversals, where your reversals have to include the top. In fact, biologically, there's nothing about the problem that suggests that the reversals are more likely to happen at one end or exclusively happen at one end. In general, what we'd like to do is to take a permutation of size n, sort it using the smallest number of reversals. Okay? And it's somewhat different than the prefix problem. Because if we did the prefix problem, every reversal had to include the top. There were only n possible choices. In the general reversal, you have a starting and stopping point for every reversal. You have n choose two reversals. You have a lot more flexibility. In general, you can sort using a far smaller number of reversals. So the diameter should go down. Okay?
What's interesting about the problem of computing reversal distance, the general reversal distance, is the algorithmic complexity depends upon whether or not you have signed permutations or unsigned permutations. If we assume that our permutations are unsigned,
namely we don't care about the fact that this reversal put that C upside down. So far we've been ignoring the orientation of the pancake. We don't care whether we get the top of the pancake and the upright and the stack at the end or not. For unsigned reversal distance, in fact, this was shown to be NP complete to find the smallest number of reversals.
What is interesting, and I think quite surprising, is that for signed permutations, genes where you know whether they have to end up in the upright position or not, in fact, there is an algorithm that will give you the minimum number of reversals you need in polynomial time. So in fact, the question of whether it's signed or unsigned makes a big difference algorithmically.
Okay.
And biologically, since we can sort of look at the genes, we know whether the sequence is here or reversed. In fact, the signed case is the one of more interest. Okay. So in the course of evolutionary analysis now, there are programs that find the minimum number of reversals. Okay, and that people can now use this to compute the evolutionary distance between two species. So one thing you might do is take the genomes of a lot of different species, let's say all the bacteria, use this algorithm to find the pairwise the distance between every pair of them. And then use some of our other phylogenetic tree algorithms to say, well, look, we want to try to find a tree layout such that we explain the minimum number of reversals you actually need. Okay, in fact, this reversal distance is the distance between them. We now have a matrix of distances we can feed through our other algorithms. Okay, any questions? Okay, any questions about evolution and mutation and reversals or anything like that? Okay, so the final business for the semester is a little bit of a reversal, where you will be grading me. Okay, here I have the course.
Instructor's student evaluation course for the course. Okay, this turns out. Hopefully, there's enough to go around.
What I want everybody to do is to, oh, and I also have pencils. Hold on. You're supposed to fill these out with pencils. Here are pencils. Let me start circulating some pencils.
Pass these things around.
Okay, so what is it that I want you to do? I want you to fill out the surveys. Honestly,
okay.
Just in case you don't know, my name is Skena, S-K-I-E-N-A. The course is CSE 549, and my line number is 2-5-1-4-5. So I want you to grade the course honestly, and I look forward to your. I like to see your comments. Okay, I do read the comments before I teach the course next time, so they will help me decide how to do the course better next year. So an a comment like "the prof sucks" is not a good comment. A comment like "the prof sucks because" with a detailed explanation is a much better, more enlightening comment. Okay? Any questions? So just read that. Let me try to make that
that number more common.
So I am S-K-I-E-N-A. The course is CSE 549, and my line number is 25145. Okay? Good.
I need a volunteer to collect the pencils and collect the forms and bring them to the CS departmental office. Do I have a volunteer? Okay, so Tom is the volunteer, okay? So make sure that you get the forms to him.
Okay, I'm going to leave the envelope here. I'm going to leave the, what? Section is one.
This is the only section.
Okay, and I'm going to collect my notes, and I'm going to turn off my audio recording. And,